Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Dale Finnegan and Doug Kretzinger. And now, here's Doug with our first story.
Quad City Times lead story on the top of the page, warning labels targeted. This is written by Caleb McAuliffe. Bill would create legal immunity for pesticide makers. Dateline is Des Moines. Iowa Senate lawmakers advanced for the second time a bill that would protect chemical manufacturers from lawsuits over failure to warn consumers about potential adverse health effects. The bill, Senate Study Bill 3188, was supported by Bayer, the manufacturer of the glyphosate-based herbicide Roundup. Bayer has been hit by lawsuits from individuals claiming it failed to warn consumers of the potential health risks of Roundup. The company has won some lawsuits against individuals alleging Roundup caused their cancer, but in other cases it has been found liable. Bayer spent more than $10 billion settling most pending claims in 2020. Under the bill, pesticide manufacturers could not be held liable for failing to warn consumers about adverse health effects in a way that exceeds the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency labeling requirements. The bill stipulates that the immunity would not apply to Chinese state-owned companies, singling out the massive agriculture and chemical company Syngenta. The bill was advanced by the two Republicans on a three-member subcommittee on Monday. It is eligible for a hearing in the full Senate Appropriations Committee. Bayer purchased Roundup maker Monsanto in 2018. The company has multiple crop science plants in Iowa, including a plant in Muscatine that manufactures Roundup. Lobbyists for Bayer and major farm groups supported the bill and told lawmakers on Monday it would prevent unfounded lawsuits against the company that creates a vital tool for farmers. Brad Epperly, a lobbyist for Bayer, said existing law and EPA regulations prevented Bayer from providing warnings that exceeded EPA's requirements. He said complying with EPA rules satisfied the company's duty to warn. "We are not in a position where we can make that kind of warning," he said. "There's no regulatory body in the entire world who finds this carcinogenic," end quote. Bayer has said it will seek a U.S. Supreme Court ruling to determine whether state-level duty to warn claims are preempted by federal law. A federal appeals court in February decided that those claims can be considered and allowed a lawsuit to go forward. Glyphosate-based herbicides like Roundup have received significant scrutiny over health claims. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency found glyphosate is not likely, end quotes, to be carcinogenic and has determined there are no, quote, risk of certain to human health, end quote. But a U.S. appeals court in 2022 vacated those findings for procedural reasons and required the agency to reconsider. A World Health Organization cancer agency found glyphosate in 2015 to be, quote, probably carcinogenic to humans, end quote. But European Union regulators have found that there was not sufficient evidence for that categorization. Environmental groups and some individuals objected to the bill, saying it would take away the ability of farmers to seek compensation when a company sells dangerous chemicals without a proper warning. Alicia Vasto, the Water Program Director for the Iowa Environmental Council, said there have been other chemicals approved by the EPA that were later found to be dangerous. Quote, "This bill would prevent Iowa farmers and rural residents from seeking justice in the future," Vasto said. She continued, "Time and time again, research has uncovered the dangers of pesticide after the EPA has declared a product safe for use," end quote. A similar bill made it partway through the lawmaking process this year before failing to pass out of either chamber before a deadline. The new bill adds the language exempting Chinese-owned companies from immunity. A lobbyist for Syngenta, which is owned by the Chinese state-owned enterprise ChemChina, called the bill discriminatory. Kelly Paskey, represented Iowa trial lawyers, said the provision might be unconstitutional. Senator Mark Costello, Republican Imogene, who is a farmer, said he was concerned that if Bayer received too many punitive court rulings related to Roundup, farmers could lose access to the product. Costello said consumers could still sue the company over specific harms, just not over a duty to warn. Quote, if they find out they've been lying to us or misrepresenting things, or if it ends up that it really is dangerous and is proven, then they can still sue under this statute, end quote, he said. Senator Bill Dotzler, Democrat Waterloo, declined to advance the bill. He said he thought there was evidence that Roundup contributed to instances of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and other cancers. Quote, I think the label should say some kind of warning that this could affect your health, end quote.
Also from the front page of the Quad City Times, a job fair for football players. This story is written by Gretchen Teske. Dressed in official polos with name cards in front of them, members of the Quad City Steam Wheelers sat patiently at tables Monday morning. But they weren't gearing up for a game or a news conference. They were at a job fair. Monday morning, Iowa Works and the Quad City Chamber of Commerce teamed up to host a reverse job fair. About a dozen steam wheelers players sat at tables with their resumes in front of them, ready to see if their skills aligned with the need of area employers. Joe Kral, an offensive lineman from New Berlin, Illinois, will celebrate his third year with the Steam Wheelers this year and went through his second job fair. The athletes are paid for their work with the team throughout the season, March through July, but the opportunity for extra compensation is hard to pass up, he said. It gives guys an opportunity to put an extra bit of change in their pocket, he said. This is usually the baseline of the pro football world, so we don't get paid too much. We're just guys who have the heart and desire to want to play ball, end quote. During his first year, Kral focused on football and did not seek out a summer job. He quickly found out attending practice in the mornings and sticking around the apartment in the afternoon was boring. Once the players are selected and signed, the Steam Wheelers franchise puts them up in an apartment complex in the area that is dedicated to team members only. The housing, utilities, and some meals are fully paid for, but that doesn't mean they don't have their own bills to pay. Real life hits you quick, Kral said with a laugh. Last year, Kral attended the job fair and found employment as a caregiver with Visiting Angels, a senior home care provider. Kral said he was paired up with Vietnam War veterans and helped them with all kinds of daily tasks. Listening to their stories, however, was his favorite part. For my benefit, I was a history guy growing up, so talking to those kids and hearing the firsthand accounts of what they have been to, just being around them and hearing the stories is better than reading a book, I think, he said. Visiting Angels director Rich Morthland said his company was able to hire about 6 steam wheelers last year. This year, he was hoping for a repeat. They're wonderful people, and they're professional athletes who have all been to college, he said. A lot of times when you're hiring people to do the work we do, they don't have the depth of the knowledge that these men do, end quote. The flyer Morthland was carrying was advertising for caregivers for Vietnam veterans, just like last year. But Visiting Angels soon found out there were other clients interested in having professional athletes around. There was a fair number of senior women who really liked the idea and the security of going around town with a big, strong man, he said with a laugh. The women loved that. We didn't expect that going in. Darian Jackson, a defensive back from Cleveland, knew that firsthand. I had a few of those jobs, he said with a laugh. They just wanted to hang out around town, end quote. Morthland said his employees did everything from housekeeping to meal preparation, but companionship and communication were always at the top of the list. The athletes practiced early in the morning on purpose to allow them time to have jobs in the afternoons. Even with them being out of town for games, visiting angels can easily work around the schedules and keep it flexible, he said. That's a strength Wyatt Havert had to offer players on Monday, too. The CEO of Digital Security Solutions, his Rock Island-based company, provides security for various events in the Quad Cities, like the Mississippi Valley Fair, and he is always looking for muscle, in quotes. Havert had never attended the job fair before, but being from a local company, he wanted to support local athletes the best that he could. Offering them jobs with the potential of picking their own on-call shifts that would work with their schedules and allow them to choose their own hours was his main pitch. At the hiring event, all employers come to the athletes and present the opportunities they have instead of the other way around. That appealed to Edward Vander, a running back and new member of the Steam Wheelers. He previously tried applying for a few jobs on Indeed, he said, but it was hard to gauge if the resume was seen or if anyone was interested in his skill set. With a bachelor's in human services and a master's in formative leadership, he was set for any leadership job, he said. Also attending for the first time was offensive lineman Paul Fay from Roscoe, Illinois. As a first-timer, he was using Monday as an opportunity to see what opportunities are in the area. The added bonus of employers understanding his commitment is to football first is helpful, he said. It's nice to have employers that have an understanding of your schedule when you're going in, he said. A graduate of Wheaton College, Fay has a bachelor's in elementary education. His resume was filled with teaching experience in various capacities, which could translate to a variety of jobs. Fay has thought about substitute teaching if it will fit his schedule, he said. But his goal was to see what was open. I honestly don't know what I'm looking for, job-wise, but I thought it would be good to be here, he said. I just want to see if anything piques my interest. The Steam Wheelers will kick off their 2024 season on Friday, March 22nd with a 7:05 p.m. home opener at Vibrant Arena in Moline against the Sioux Falls Storm.
And student broadcasters are cited. The SAU-TV named Best College Television Station in Nation, St. Ambrose University, written by Olivia Allen. St. Ambrose University's student-run television station, SAU-TV, earned the title of Best College University Television Station from the Intercollegiate Broadcast System, IBS, earlier this month. The SAU-TV team accepted this award at the 85th Annual Media Awards Ceremony in Times Square, New York City, a shocking yet unforgettable experience for many. It was junior Ryan Schitzel's first time in New York City. Quote, being in the heart of it all, the sights and sounds were all pretty cool, the digital media production major from Chicago said. The university's student radio station KALA and SAU-TV were nominated for 6 awards at the 2-day conference. Schitzel and 2 other students were nominated for Best Sports Play-by-Play for covering the SAU women's soccer team's victory in the 2024 conference championship. Upon not hearing their names announced for the individual awards, Schistel and said he and his peers felt down in the dumps. But the IBS saved Best Television Station for the end of the ceremony. We actually thought we went through every nomination SAU had, so when we heard our names at the last minute, we were kind of shocked, he said. I think it was a sense of just overall happiness, but also a bit of disbelief, end quote. Since KALA and SAU-TV often work hand in hand, all attending students accepted the award on stage together. Overall, when we heard our names called, it was a lot of rejoicement, Schietzel said. It's just one of those things when you're kind of in shock, but at the same time, you're just so happy to know that you won a national award, he said. While not on the trip, senior Lillian Reed said she and other students on the SAU-TV team kept tabs on the IBS Awards virtually. Quote, it was kind of a surreal feeling, she said, of hearing SAU-TV win the award. We had gotten a message probably 5 minutes prior saying we didn't win anything up to that point, end quote. While the SAU-TV team meets in the studio only twice a week, Reed considers them to be like family. Quote, hearing we won was an amazing feeling, she said, knowing we're a big family and we all support each other in what we do, end quote. Since joining SAU-TV, Reed, a senior sports management major, feels more confident creating a variety of media content and working with fast turnaround deadlines and assignments. The other thing is the connections I've been able to make from SAU-TV even outside the class, Reed said, explaining her professors have brought in former colleges, or colleagues and local news industry professionals into class. After graduating from SAU this spring, Reed plans to explore opportunities in St. Paul, Minnesota, her hometown. Hopefully, getting somewhere within the field of sports, she said, whether it's being behind the camera or helping out with gameplay stuff like doing play-by-play or color commentary, eventually, end quote. Schietzel also wants to stay in sports broadcasting after SAU, and he's learned several key lessons during his time with both SAU-TV and KALA. Don't be afraid to try something new. Always say yes to the stories, he said. Going in, I only wanted to do sports stories, but they, faculty, want us to dip our feet into everything, end quote. Communication skills and how to be a professional are other key takeaways Schietzel cites from his time in SAU-TV so far, along with a willingness to support, help other, to support and help others. Quote, because if you do that in a field like this, it'll come back to help you in the future, he said. Armstrong said SAU's Communication and Digital Media Department took a hands-on approach with students. Quote, our students work hard all year to develop their skills and passions in the art of visual storytelling. We want to foster a creative environment where everyone can learn and understand effective multimedia communication, he said in an SAU news release. Through our classes, our students produce multiple television broadcasts per week, which is the best way to learn the craft, end quote. Among the more than 3,000 IBS awards entries, SAU-TV was nominated in the same category as bigger schools such as Auburn University and the University of Santo Tomas in the Philippines. Both SAU-TV and KALA Radio will compete for regional awards this spring at the Midwest Broadcast Journalist Association Awards in Minneapolis and the Iowa Broadcast News Association Awards in Des Moines in April. I'm just excited to see, you know, how much more we can win, Schietzel said, noting SAU-TV and KALA success will help attract and retain students. We've got two great programs that I definitely think deserve the national credit. We're willing to compete with these bigger schools and, you know, we're able to win. Clearly, we are the best of the best, end quote. After SAU, he's willing to go, quote, anywhere and everywhere to explore jobs in sports broadcasting with dreams to one day land a job at ESPN, Fox Sports, CBS, and other major sports outlets.
Turning to the local page of the Quad City Times, the headline at the top of the page reads, Haircuts for Healthcare, event to promote health screenings for black men. This article is written by Gannon Hannevold. This weekend, Unity Point Health and other local organizations are teaming up for a free event, hoping to raise awareness about regular health screenings for black men. It's a meeting point of hoops, haircuts, and health that they're dubbing Buzzer Beaters and Bad Hair Days. It'll start at 10 a.m. on Saturday, March 23rd at the Lincoln Center in Davenport, located at 318 East 7th Street. Unity Point and its local partners will offer lunch, games, and free haircuts, according to a media release shared this month. We believe that empowering men with knowledge and access to preventative health care services is critical in improving overall health outcomes, Teresa Pangan, prevention and wellness strategist at Unity Point, said in the release. She continued, "By connecting with our community in the places they already frequent, we can encourage proactive health management and early detection through education and access to life-saving health screenings, ultimately leading to healthier, happier lives," end quote. The release cited statistics from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that show that Black men have the lowest life expectancy and the highest death rates compared to men and women of other racial and ethnic groups. This event is an extension of Unity Point's Medicine in the Barbershop initiative, which utilizes local barbers to help advance conversations about men's health and wellness. During this Saturday's event, men will have access to important health education, including information on blood pressure, diabetes, and cancer screenings, the release said. The event will run from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. and will be emceed by Michael Cribbs, Outreach Director for the Davenport YMCA. He said, "Prioritizing your health isn't just a personal choice. It's a gift you give to yourself and your family. Taking care of yourself enables you to continue enjoying quality time with your loved ones." The event will be open to men and their families. Its schedule will coincide with the second round of the men's and women's NCAA basketball tournaments.
All right, fire damages residents in Bettendorf is a story on the local page. Sarah Watson wrote this. Bettendorf firefighters responded to a home fire at the manor in Bettendorf in the early hours of Sunday morning. According to a news release, Bettendorf Fire and Rescue responded to a residential structure fire at 2:42 a.m. Sunday at a unit at the manor, 1104 Kimberly Road. One resident was home when the fire started but was outside when fire crews arrived. Fire crews noticed heavy smoke and some flames when they entered the home and quickly extinguished the fire. Firefighters searched the unit and adjoining units. Fire did not extend beyond the first unit. Just light smoke was cleared from those homes, according to the news release. The unit is currently uninhabitable because of fire and smoke damage, according to the news release. Utilities have been shut off to the unit, and the investigation is ongoing. No injuries were reported at the time of the fire, the news release stated. Restaurant Week in Quad Cities is April 8th through 14th. Gannon Hannibal wrote this. For the 12th year, Visit Quad Cities is hosting Quad City Restaurant Week, a 7-day celebration of all of the Quad City's best dine-in locations. This year, Quad City Restaurant Week will be held from Monday, the 8th of April, to Sunday, April 14. The annual event encourages locals to branch out and try new restaurants for a week filled with the deals and events. We look forward to hosting giveaways, promoting restaurant specials, and sharing excitement of Restaurant Week with our community next month, said Lindsay Rowe, Director of Public Relations and Communications at Visit Quad Cities. This year's Restaurant Week will also feature the return of the Surprise a Server program, where customers can recognize outstanding individuals in the local food scene. Last year, Visit Quad Cities received over 200 nominations. Submissions are open from now until March 29. Nominate a server at qcrestaurantweek.com/nominate-a-server. This year's roster of participating restaurants is record-breaking, the organization said in a release, with more than 100 local spots participating. You can browse a map of participating restaurants at qcrestaurantweek.com/restaurants. And Quad City Restaurant Week will be held from April 8 to 14, 2024. And there are, it looks like 150 restaurants here that I could talk about and read through, but I'm not going to. So that's the story. I'm going to turn it over to Dale.
Speaking of restaurants and food, I'm going to continue with another Gannon Hanevold article, his viewpoint, The Best Thing I Ate. This week's title is Max Mac Smacks and I'll Be Back. Here's his story. St. Patrick's Day weekend has passed, but that doesn't mean you can't still check out a local Irish pub. Max Tavern in downtown Davenport has been open for 90 years, and it's easy to see why. I first tried the spot a few weeks ago, and with March 17th around the corner last week, I knew I had to stop in again before it got too busy. The first time I dined there, I was able to try a wide variety of the tavern's appetizers. The fried pickle spears are delicious and crisp, a heartier spin on the more common pickled chips. I also tried the elote chicken adobo dip, a white queso dip that you'll be lucky to pull your chip out of without a few stringers. Of course, I snacked on the cheese curds, too. This time around, I went a different cheesy route, and I'd recommend it to anyone who steps through the Max Tavern doors. The dish? Max Mac and Cheese. Well, hey, if you're going to Max, you might as well get Mac, right? The dish's affordable price first caught my eye. And by the time I put two and two together, I knew I'd have to try it. Mac's signature mac and cheese is made with four cheeses and topped with Parmesan breadcrumbs. The hardened cheddar on the top layer of the dish is a seal worth breaking into. Their mac and cheese also comes with a side slice of buttered French bread, which I'd recommend using to clean up as much cheese as you can from the bottom of the bowl. The Mac at Max marks one of the rare instances where a protein isn't needed to make this filling as a main entree. The serving size is already hefty enough to be a meal on its own. It could also safely be a side to share if you and date want to try a few options. If you feel as if dinner isn't complete without a centerpiece protein, don't worry. I'm that way too. You can add grilled chicken, Philly steak, or bangers for a small upcharge. I went with the chicken, which was soft enough to cut straight through and plentiful enough to last through the whole bowl. It added a nice extra bit of weight to an already carbo-loaded dish. The price of $6.75 is truly the selling point. Anytime you can get a gut-stuffing dish for under $7 is a steal, let alone something that's a restaurant's signature recipe and delicious, too. It costs an extra $5.25 to add any of the proteins listed above, a reasonable addition considering most places would charge upward of $15 for a protein pasta. It's located at 316 West 3rd Street in Davenport, a walking distance to modern Woodman Park in case you want to grab a bite before or after catching a game come baseball season. It's also relatively close to the Figge Art Museum if you're interested in balancing the yin of fine arts with the yang of bar fare. Their kitchen is open from 4 to 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, 4 to 10 p.m. on Friday, 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Saturday, and 3 p.m. to 9 p.m. on Sunday. The ambiance, local and Irish proud. As I mentioned earlier, the timing of this food column is no coincidence. I felt an obligation to check out Max last week because of their outward and proud Irish roots. During St. Patrick's week, the place was adorned with Irish flags galore. Large and small, they hung around the bar and into the dining area. At the back of the restaurant, there are two large circular tables in case you're planning to dine with a big party, with the main dining room lined with wall-adjacent four-person booths. There are also signifiers all over the Max interior that indicate local pride. There's Bix 7 memorabilia, Palmer College fraternity insignia, and flyers for past St. Patrick's Day parades. There's also a whole lot of history inside and outside the Max walls. The vintage neon sign outside the restaurant is a staple of 3rd Street. The floors inside Max are lined with the original terrazzo tiles, and the ceiling has the original tin tiles. In between is the 40-foot bar built by the original owner, Bill Mack McLaughlin. There are TV screens at each of the room's corners, making it a reasonable spot to keep up to date with men's and women's March Madness tournaments this weekend. The service is fast, albeit a little bit terse, but I won't complain. After this last weekend, I'm still feeling lucky because the Max Mac smacks, and I'm sure I'll be back. And on a program note, you are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. It's now time for obituaries, and I will turn that over to Doug to begin.
James Berryhill, 80 years old of Davenport, passed away March 13 at Ridgecrest Village. Cremation rites have been accorded per his wishes. Funeral services will be held on Friday, the 22nd. At Wirtz Funeral Home at 11 a.m. with burial to follow at Rose Hill Cemetery. Memorials may be left to the River Bend Food Bank and online condolences may be expressed at wirtzfh.com. James was born July 15, 1943 on the family farm in Popejoy, Iowa to Irwin and Ruth Bond Berryhill. He attended Muscatine Community College and Iowa State University. James served in the United States Army from February of 65 to August of 67 as a Spec 4 in Germany. He is survived by his siblings, and he was preceded in death by his parents, Irvin and Ruth Bond Berryhill, brother William Berryhill, and brother-in-law Harold McAuliffe. Richard D. Ocar, O-C-A-R, 92, of Davenport, died March 17 at Clarissa C. Cook Hospice House, Bettendorf. Visitation will be held March 21 from 4 until 6 p.m. at the Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home in Davenport. There will be additional visitation March 22nd from 9 until 10 a.m. A time of sharing will take place at 10 a.m. March 22nd at the funeral home, followed by burial at the Rock Island National Cemetery, Arsenal Island, with military honors. Memorials may be made to the St. Ambrose Athletic Department or Clarissa C. Cook Hospice House. Richard was born on June 17, 1931 in Chicago, a son of Joseph of Genevieve Budzik Ocar. Richard graduated from St. Ambrose in 1953 with a degree in business. He proudly served from 1956 until 1958 in the Army. He was a vice president of sales at Frank Foundry and retired as vice president of Black Hawk Foundry. He was a former member of the board of Bettendorf Public Library during his lifetime. He was a member of our local country clubs. He was a current member of the Outing Club. Online condolences may be expressed by visiting hmdfuneralhome.com. Pauline Grace Holloway, H-O-L-L-O-W-A-Y, LeClaire, 65 years old, of LeClaire, passed away Friday the 15th of March. A celebration of life be held on Sunday the 24th, from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Crow Valley Golf Club with a time of sharing at 2:30 p.m. Memorials in Pauline's name may be made to the Humane Society of Scott County or to King's Harvest Animal Rescue. Pauline was born on April 9, 1958 in Dublin, Ireland, to Patrick and Marguerite Holloway. Following her schooling in England, she worked at the National Westminster Bank. Pauline moved to the United States in 1978 as a nanny. She attended DMAC and the University of Iowa. She worked in sales for many years, and her latest endeavor was with her own company, Angus Merchandising. Pauline was a social butterfly and would benefit, or rather befriend, anyone and everyone she met in her adventures. She was very fashionable, the epitome of elegance and class. Her best accessory was her beautiful smile. Pauline met her life partner, Colin McCumber, in 1998, and they spent 25 wonderful years together. In the summer, they could be found boating on the Mississippi River. Pauline and her beloved dog, Angus, would walk the beach collecting shells. Those left to honor her memory are her life partner, Colin McCumber, children Amber, Ian, and Casey, grandchildren Corey and Willa Smith, Ryder Hudson and Liam McCumber, and sisters Vivian Holloway and Slobane Hayase, nephews Sean and Connor Alchin and Kay Hayase, her auntie Joan Curry, mother-in-law Sandra McCumber, sisters-in-law Wendy Laudy and Holly Mike Ladalupi, best friend Cindy Scholey, many cousins worldwide. Online condolences may be left to Pauline's family by visiting her obituary, wurtzfh.com.
Emmett Buzz Holst, Jr., age 91, died Saturday, March 16th at Genesis East in Davenport, surrounded by his loved ones. Funeral services will be held March 21st at noon at the Runge Mortuary and Crematory. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to service time. In lieu of flowers, it was Emmett's wish to have a bench placed in his honor at West Lake Park, one of his favorite fishing spots. Emmett was born June 5, 1932, in Davenport, to Emmett Holst Sr. and Mary Kathleen Larson. Emmett grew up in Scott and Clinton counties. In 1950, Emmett graduated from Welton High School. He enlisted in the U.S. Navy in April of 1951 and served in the Korean War on the USS Diamond Head as quartermaster, second class, signalman, and helmsman for special detail in the U.S., Canada, Spain, France, Italy, Greece, Liberia, Balearic Island, and Gibraltar until being honorably discharged in March of 1955. Emmett married the mother of his six children, Betty Carson, in 1956, and married Beverly Cady in 1980. Emmett worked at Star Forms in Bettendorf and Oscar Mayer in Davenport for 24 years, retiring in 1994. In 1994, Emmett and Bev moved to The Farm in Clarence, Iowa, a dream fulfilled. In 2005, they moved to Davenport to be closer to their children and family. Emmett had many good times fishing and playing cards with his good friends, Gary and Donnie, along with his children and grandchildren. He loved his Cubbies and Iowa Hawkeyes. Emmett's proudest achievement was serving in the Navy. He may not have remembered what he did yesterday, but he remembered the men and what he did in the Navy. He cherished his Navy reunions and was a member of AEAOE Sailors Association. He was very honored and proud to have his latest great-grandson named after him. Memorials will go toward the bench or a charity of the family's choice. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.rungemortuary.com. Benjamin D. Elmer. Funeral services and massive Christian burial for Benjamin D. Elmer, age 34, of Bettendorf, will be held at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, March 20th at St. John Vianney Catholic Church in Bettendorf. Interment will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery in Davenport. The family will receive friends from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday at the church. Memorials may be made to Night to Shine, Tim Tebow Foundation, or King's Harvest Pet Rescue. Benjamin Daniel Elmer was born November 14, 1989, in Evanston, Illinois, a son of Scott and Deborah Byrne Elmer, Sr. He earned his bachelor's degree in architectural studies from the University of Colorado, Denver, and had worked for the Rock Island Arsenal, Liggett Architects, and most recently Stanley Consultants. He enjoyed fishing, golfing, camping, listening to music, and was an advocate for helping others. Those left to honor his memory include his parents, his brother Scott, and nieces and nephews. Online remembrances and condolences may be expressed at the website hmdfuneralhome.com.
I'm going to turn now to the opinion section of the paper. Here's a one entitled Another View, Bloomberg News. Grade inflation exacerbates learning loss. It contributes to higher rates of absenteeism and worse performance on standard tests, is how the lead is. Recent test results confirm a dispiriting reality. America's students continue to lag far behind their peers around the world, and millions are running out of time to catch up. Yet many families remain unaware of the true deficits their children face, in no small part because teachers are often giving students higher grades than they actually deserve. The grading systems used in K-12 schools vary widely, but there's evidence that the padding of classroom grades has become routine. Over the past decade, average scores on the ACT college entrance exam declined in English, math, social studies, and science, yet test takers self-reported grade point averages in all four subjects went up. In 2010, 43% of test takers reported earning A's in math, while 41% received B's. By 2022, 54% received A's and only 35% got B's. The number with C's fell to 10% from 15%. The pandemic made things worse. An analysis of middle and high schoolers in Washington State found that average GPAs in math rose from 2.36 in 2019 to 2.70 in 2021, more than triple the rate of improvement over the previous 8 years, even as standardized test scores dropped. Several pedagogical trends are contributing to grade inflation. In recent decades, calls to promote equity and boost disadvantaged students have spurred districts to adopt more generous grading policies. This includes recalibrating traditional 100-point grading scales, discontinuing the use of letter grades, increasing opportunities to retake exams, and judging students on their mystery of material rather than on, mastery of material rather than on things like homework and class participation. Schools became even more lenient during the pandemic, waiving penalties for poor attendance and scrapping rules to hold back unready students. Defenders of such measures claim that awarding higher grades can boost kids' self-confidence at a time of heightened social and emotional challenges. Educators need to be sensitive to those concerned, but compromising academic standards will only do more damage. Areas that have eased grading policies have suffered higher rates of absenteeism and worse performance on standardized assessments, with low-achieving students seeing the biggest declines. Policymakers should insist schools address the pervasiveness of grade inflation. Districts should be required to lower grades for students who are chronically absent. Teachers should be encouraged to maintain vigorous grading standards and rewarded if their students subsequently demonstrate improvements on standardized assessments. Schools should make public aggregate grade point averages by age and subject area alongside standardized test results. Above all, educators and parents need a renewed commitment to be honest with students about the academic deficits they face and the work required to address them. Handing out good grades for subpar work isn't helping anyone.
The second opinion today, I'll go ahead and describe the political cartoon first. It is a My View cartoon drawn by Steve Breen. And in the drawing, we see a U-Haul van front and center. A man is driving, a woman is seated next to him, a child is in the third seat waving to a blurry housing development in the background. On that housing development, it says California housing costs. On the van, they have taped a sign that says affordable state or bust. And at the very top of the cartoon, the whole title is Westward Ho, with the west crossed out and changed to east. So Eastward Ho. And they're escaping the apparently high California housing costs in their U-Haul van. The opinion that I will read is written by Kathleen Parker. The title is, For the Sake of Our Country, Harris Should Step Aside. The Democratic Party's indulgence of identity politics has proved successful in building a diverse organization. but its strategy of courting and pandering to minority voters is the road to ruin. In 2020, Joe Biden's promise to tap a black woman as his vice president, along with Representative James E. Clyburn's election altering endorsement in South Carolina, paved Biden's way to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. His history-making selection of the telegenic Kamala D. Harris might prove to be his downfall in 2024. And he's had enough fall downs to make voters worry. Harris's resume was impressive. A former California Attorney General and sitting U.S. Senator, she seemed to have been created by central casting. Or was it artificial intelligence? As the first black woman and the first woman of Asian descent to be nominated for vice president, she was a doubleheader. But her evolving beliefs undercut that appeal. As a presidential candidate in 2020, she followed the Democratic playbook on issues, except when she raised her hand in support of eliminating private health insurance. She also managed to imply that Biden was racist and segregationist, citing his long-ago stance against student busing. In her famous debate rebuke of Biden, she said she had been one of the little black girls on one of those buses. Her touche was short-lived. Harrison ended her campaign in December of 2019, citing a lack of financial resources. Next thing we knew, she was moving into the Naval Observatory. She was a colossal failure as a border czar, a position she held briefly and otherwise seemed to have gone undercover. Whatever the reasons, it has seemed that Harris's role was to be quiet, lest she embarrass her boss with her sometimes inane, rambling remarks and a laugh that erupts from nowhere about nothing obvious to others. But I do relish the thought of her face-to-face with Vladimir Putin and suddenly cackling at a linchpin moment during nuclear arms discussions. The Kamala conundrum comes down to this. She was picked because she was black and female, a combo tantamount to job security. Now that she's become a burden to the Democratic ticket, Biden can't fire her. He can't break his promise to his base. Full stop. The seriousness of this situation can't be overstated. Biden's diminishing faculties, notwithstanding his relatively successful State of the Union address, and his increasingly physical frailty are concerning. Every honest person knows he's not in top form. A recent New York Times poll found 73% of registered voters believe Biden is too old to be the nation's top executive. This includes 61% of those who voted for him in 2020. At the start of Biden's term, I was pulling for Harris to do well. She had pizzazz and a reputation for being a tough prosecutor. She had moxie and swagger, and she leaned centrist. There was reason for hope. Criticism from California progressives that she wasn't adequately attuned to racial justice issues and sided too often with prosecutors likely proved helpful when she was vetted for the VP spot. Her performance as second in command has been disappointing, to say the least. Americans have taken note. Though Democrats, unsurprisingly, like her more than Republicans do, a recent analysis by 538 set her average overall approval rating at just 37%, among the lowest recorded for a vice president. There's no reason to think her ranking would surge were she suddenly promoted to the Oval Office. Instead, most signs point to disaster. This is why I propose, with all due respect, that Harris step away from the ticket. This is not a partisan suggestion. I said the same about Sarah Palin in 2008 when it became clear, as I wrote, that she was, quote, out of her league. No one would have blamed Palin for wanting to spend more time with her family, including a new baby, I said. I ended the column with these words, quote, do it for your country, end quote. Harris could provide her own reasons for moving on. Perhaps she and Biden could cut a deal for her to become the next attorney general, if he's reelected. Biden then could tap someone else with executive experience who could reassure voters that the next vice president would be ready to take the reins should events require it. Democrats and Republicans alike would be relieved. Please, Madam Vice President, do it for your country. Again, that opinion comes from Kathleen Parker, who writes for The Washington Post.
Time to go to sports, the sports section for Tuesday, March 19. Prep girls basketball, Illinois All-Stars 82, Iowa All-Stars 66. And headline reads, Illinois girls top Iowa for All-Star win. It's written by Samir Mala. New teammates, a university arena, Hawkeye-style line changes. Such was the scene at Augustana College's Carver Center Arena as the Illinois All-Stars defeated the Iowa All-Stars 82-66 on Monday night. That was a fun experience. The girls had a good time, said Black Hawk College's Logan Fry, who was coaching Team Illinois. The Iowa All-Stars started slowly to open the game. Once the first quarter was over, Team Iowa shot only 2 of 20 from the field. Team Illinois took advantage with United Township's Lorena Awau, A-W-O-U, and Galesburg's Kiara Kilgore combined for 11 of the team's 22 points, racing to a 22-7 lead. Awu, A-W-O-U, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, who was named the All-Star Game MVP, finished with a team-high 21 points, going 7-for-9 from the field and collecting 8 rebounds in the win. Michaela Farnham of Davenport North led all scores in the game with 21 points for the Iowa All-Stars. Awu had a blast on the court following the rigors of a long United Township season. After a bucket with 8 minutes left in the first half, Awu stuck her tongue out in joy. On the previous possession, she was in a jump ball with Davenport North's Kira Taylor, and both had a laugh down the other side of the court. Lorena had one of the least amount of minutes, but she made the biggest impact, Fry said. She did a great job. It was easy for the girls to find her, and she was great inside. Alleman's Audrey Erickson, who was also playing for Team Illinois and finished with 7 points, including 2 of 3 from three-point range, also gave some praise to Awau, an opponent during Western Big Six action, but for one day, a teammate. Quote, she is so tall, man, Erickson said of Awau. She is so hard to guard. She has got great footwork. She has put in a lot of work over the years, and she has really improved. She really deserved the MVP award, end quote. Team Iowa got their groove back in the second quarter, shooting 40% from the field, 8 of 20. However, they could not get any closer as Team Illinois widened the lead to 43-26 by halftime. To show support for her Illinois teammate, Alleman's Claire Hulkey and Awu stood up from the scorer's table after United Township's Kaylee Pina drained a right wing three-pointer with just over a minute left in the third quarter, expanding the lead to 61-37. With Iowa trailing, Pleasant Valley head coach Jennifer Getz went to a full-court press in the top fourth quarter. One of the best moments for Iowa happened with just under 3 minutes left. Pina was a streaking Awu racing down the field. However, the ball was tipped, and in a tic-tac-toe passing drill with the ball not touching the ground, Team Iowa was able to connect on a layup to cut the deficit to 76-62. Alleman's Audrey Erickson capped the game with a three-point pointer from the Beyond the Augustana logo at the fourth quarter buzzer for Team Illinois. Time was running out, and I just let it go, Erickson said. Fry agreed. That was awesome, she said of the buzzer beater. Audrey pulled up with no hesitation. 1, 2, and then swish. It was awesome and good to see. Pina added 14 points for the Illinois All-Stars. Cameron Houston of Monmouth, Roseville, chipped in with 11. Three-point contest. The girls' three-point contest for both the girls and the boys took place at halftime of the girls' game. Format was one Iowa shooter facing an Illinois one. With three players from each state chosen after Sunday's practice session, each player had 30 seconds on the clock to make as many three-pointers from one spot beyond the collegiate three-point line. The two players with the highest force score faced off in the final. The first round featured Awu taking on Lexi Hayes of Davenport Assumption, Davenport North's Michaela Farnham against Galesburg's Alexis Edgerton, and Muscatine's Briley Seaman versus United Worship's or Township's Kylie Pina. On the Illinois side, Edgerton and Pina tied for the first with six made threes. Because they tied, a 30-second tiebreaker was held with Edgerton prevailing 3-1. In the final, Seaman was waiting, but it was Edgerton that prevailed 5-3 for the win.
Just a little bit of a local brief here before we finish up. Auggies Ranieri honored. Augustana's Nadia Ranieri has been named the CCIW Co-Pitcher of the Week with Kelsey Bruno of Milliken. Ranieri, a senior lefty from North Riverside, Illinois, went 2-0 last week, allowing just one run in 13 and two-thirds innings. She allowed just six hits total and struck out 11. For the season, Ranieri is 3-0 with a 1.75 ERA. The Vikings, with a record of 5-3, are scheduled to host North Central on Tuesday. And that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today, Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. I'm Dale Finnegan, and my partner at the microphone has been Doug Kretzinger. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.